Is this music expressive of? To the ninth degree, it's expressive about the meaning of the words. And that's it. Do we gain any insight, my friends, into the joy and euphoria that Oriana must feel having been drawn to all of these strange little creatures?
You like me. You love me. You adorable things, you. And I love you, too.
Do we feel the pain of Vesta having been abandoned by these ingrates, in Ricky Waters' famous words? For who? For what? A mortal queen? Does she swear vengeance? You dirty, rotten nymphs and shepherds. I'm gonna get you. And your little Vesta, too. No, there's no vendetta. There's no insight into personal feelings. I mean, she doesn't even give him a guilt trip. It's not about individual feelings, this madrigal or any madrigal. In its clever word painting, does this madrigal embody that elusive Renaissance ideal, the Greek ideal, that music could and should change the face of nature and the souls of people by celebrating the sanctity and power of individual emotions? No, this madrigal does not celebrate individual emotions. Madrigals can't do that because there's too many people singing at the same time. So, the artistic search for the Greek ideal continues. Our next step, the invention of opera. Thank you. Welcome to How to Listen to and Understand Opera. Lecture 5. Now, lectures 5 through 8 are conceived as a set, and they are entitled as a group, The Invention of Opera and Monteverdi's Orfeo. Now, please, before we get into The Invention of Opera and Monteverdi's Orfeo, it is absolutely necessary for us to do a brief but intense review of some of the most salient things discussed in Lecture 4. And we go back to the Greek view, the Greek ideal of music. Ancient Greek culture celebrated music as a force of nature that could change the souls of human beings and animals. A very powerful and ultimately humanistic view of music. Now, during the Renaissance, that period in Europe, and we're talking about the musical Renaissance now, that period in Europe that spans approximately the years 1400 to 1600, we see a growing awareness of this Greek view, this Greek ideal of music, even if the Renaissance scholars and philosophers and artists and composers had not a clue of what Greek music actually sounded like. They did have the literature written by the Greeks that said our music was capable of these tremendous expressive effects. So this essentially humanistic, emotionally expressive view of music galvanized the thinkers and musicians of the Renaissance. We can imagine Renaissance composers thinking to themselves, my goodness, I want my listeners to respond to my music the way the ancient Greeks said that their listeners responded to their music. Perhaps the most important experimental genre of music of the Renaissance was the madrigal, a late 16th century genre, which based expression on what we call word painting or tone painting. That is, expression became the words being sung. And the job of the composer was to illustrate the meaning of the words with the proper musical gesture. In the last lecture, lecture 4, we listened to a madrigal by an English composer, Thomas Weelkes, As Vesta Was From Latmos Hill Descending. And we heard all kinds of wonderful musical effects that illustrated the meaning of the words. When we hear the word descending, the music descends, and so forth. This is what word painting and tone painting are. We're going to listen to another madrigal now, because one madrigal does not a study make, and frankly, an English madrigal is pleasant, nice, and bubbly, but it's not really representative of the true Italian madrigal, and that's what we've got to deal with right now. We're going to listen to a madrigal, a true Italian madrigal, by Carlo Gesualdo, Prince of Venosa, called Io Parto e Non Più Dissi. This piece dates from about 1595. It wasn't published until 1611, but certainly it dates from the late 16th century. Let me read you this text, and while I read you this text, ask yourselves, please, what's this all about? I am leaving. And I said no more, for grief had robbed my heart of life. Then Clory began to weep and said, with interrupted cries of alas, oime, alas. Therefore, with my agony I remain. Oh, may I never cease to languish in such pain. I was dead, and now I am alive, for my dead spirits return to life at the sound of such pathetic accents. Oh, my goodness, what could this be about? Well, first of all, it's much more typical of your basic madrigal bosom-beating text. It's about a breakup. It's about two people parting their ways. I am leaving, and said no more, for grief had robbed my heart of life. Okay, that's me. Then Clory, the other person, began to weep and said with interrupted cries of oime. Look, this word oime, we're going to hear so many oimes today, it's going to be coming out of our ears, noses, and anywhere else you want to imagine. Without the word oime, or alas, it would seem that all late madrigals and early opera would be impossible. One encounters it rather almost too often. Oime, therefore with my agony I remain, says Clory. Ah, may I never cease to languish in such pain. Oh, she's pathetically unhappy. And then I respond again. I was dead, and now I am alive, for my dead spirits return to life at the sounds of such pathetic accents. Yes, she's so unhappy that even though I thought I was dead, I've got to be alive, because only a living person could feel so rotten hearing all of this pathetic carrying on. All right, there's our text for this madrigal, and here's the word painting I want you to be aware of while we listen to it. First, and most importantly, the unbelievable degree of harmonic complexity. My friends, this music is going to sound like a barbershop quartet well into its fourth pitcher of martinis. The harmonies are going to be slipping and sliding all over the place. This complexity, this lack of resolution, this oily move from one key to the next, seemingly inexplicable in motion, reflects the sense of emotional turmoil and irresolution that the story is all about. Second thing I want you to be aware of, whenever they mention the word dolore, grief, sadness, sorrow, dolore will always be expressed in long notes. Dolore, languorous and unhappy. Whenever we hear the word vita, life, it will always be in fast, upbeat notes. Vita, 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 vita. Whenever we hear the word morte, death, we will hear it expressed in the longest, lowest possible tones. Morte. Is this starting to sound a little silly? It is a little silly, but it's a very engaging piece. Spiriti spenti, exhausted dead spirits, will be portrayed with descending wraith-like lines. And lastly, the very last word of this madrigal is the word accenti. And this is a double entendre. An accento was a flourish, an embellishment, a stepwise embellishment. So if you said to a singer at this time, I want you to add an accento, they would do one of these little embellishments. But of course, accenti also means accents, or statements in this case. And so when our singer utters the word accenti, meaning Clory's pathetic cries, he uses this wonderful little embellishment as an illustration. So it's a double entendre, both a musical statement and the word itself in its meaning. Let's listen. Let's be aware again of this incredibly complex harmonic stuff that creates a sense of irresolution and dissatisfaction. And always, while listening to this, ask yourselves, what is being expressed in this music? Gesualdo, io parto. I trust we heard that extraordinary dissonance when Clory says, dolorosi. For the listener of this particular recording, hearing it for the first time, one might think, my goodness, they're singing wrong notes. Oh, no. They're singing precisely what Gesualdo wrote. Major amounts of dissonance, unresolved dissonance that corresponds with the dissonance being felt by the characters at this particular moment. Now, I asked you before, I ask you again. what's being expressed in this music. First and foremost, the text itself, with these long notes on morto and these short notes on vita and so forth. And a certain generic melancholy and unfulfillment is, of course, created by the tremendous amount of chromaticism. That's what we call this harmonic irregularity and complexity, and a lack of harmonic resolution. But here's the big point, and I'm making it for the second time in two lectures. While the incredible harmonic and polyphonic complexity of this madrigal, it's for five voices singing something different all the time, while this complexity can evoke a mood, can this complexity evoke the sense of individual, pointed, singular, and personal emotion? No, it cannot. So as I said in Lecture 4, the search for other expressive musical means that can continues. Which brings us now to another late Renaissance genre of music called the intermezzo or the intermedio. Parallel to the late 16th century development of the madrigal was the intermezzo or the intermedio. It's the same thing. We just have two terms. Opera historian Donald Grout tells us that intermezzi and intermedi were a class of 16th century works in which the role of music was to offer diversion in connection with a regular spoken play. So what Grout is telling us is that these intermezzi or intermedi were musical diversions occurring in the course of a regular theatrical spoken play. As is well known, one of the features of the Renaissance was the revival of secular drama. The movement began in Italy towards the end of the 15th century, that's the end of the 1400s, with performances of Latin plays, in the original or in translation, under courtly auspices at various centers, of which Ferrara, Rome, Florence, Mantua, and Venice were particularly prominent. And I would add that those cities will soon become the early centers of Italian opera, given as they are to theatric entertainment. Many new plays were written in Latin or in Italian, imitated from classical models. Practically all these plays made use of music to a greater or less extent, though in a subordinate, decorative fashion. There were occasional solos or duets, choruses, these especially in tragedies based on Greek originals, madrigals, and even sometimes instrumental pieces. The general tendency was to separate the musical numbers from the play itself by placing the musical numbers in the prologue, that means at the very beginning, or at the ends of the acts, so that they appeared as an intermezzo or an intermedio, that is, something intermediate to the actual action of the play. Now, often because of the quality of the music, which was high in these intermezzi, or simply because of the scale of their productions, the intermezzi became more interesting than the play that they were plugged into itself. John Addington Symonds wrote, or rather he sniffed, unhappily in his book Renaissance Italian Culture, quote, "For the majority of the audience, the music and the pageants formed the chief attraction. It's therefore no marvel if the drama, considered as a branch of high poetic art, was suffocated by the growth of its mere accessories." Unquote. Music as a mere accessory. Well, Mr. Symonds, one could say that your drama was a mere accessory to our music, but I would never say such a thing. Look, the intermedio was important, in fact, vital as a forerunner of opera, for two essential reasons. First, because it kept alive in the minds of Italian poets and musicians the idea of close collaboration between drama and music. And second, because in these works, in these intermezzi, the external form of opera is already clear. A drama with interludes of music, dancing, splendid scenery, and spectacular stage effects. As soon as the drama itself would be set to music, that is, as soon as we'd actually set the words to music, opera would be achieved. Now, what almost all of these intermezzi or intermedi had in common is that they were based in plays that were what we call pastorales. So let me tell you a little bit about the content of these actual plays, these
pastorals. The pastorale was a style of dramatic poetry that dominated Italian theater in the late 16th and early 17th centuries. That's the late 1500s and the early 1600s. In 1598, Antonio Ingegneri, who I would tell you was the foremost writer on theater of his time, wrote this, quote, "If it were not for the pastorals, it might be said that the theater was extinct," unquote. Probably the sort of overstatement critics are given to, but the point is clear, and that is it would seem that whatever theater you go to, it's another pastorale, another pastorale. Why not some science fiction? Why not something else? Well, that's what's popular, so that's what's being staged. A dramatic pastorale is a poem, lyric in substance, but dramatic in form, intended for either reading or for stage presentation. It's got shepherds and shepherdesses and various sylvan deities as its main characters, and uses as background fields and forests and other rather Arcadian and attractive natural scenes. The dramatic action is typically restricted to mild love adventures and the kind of incidents that arise out of pastoral life. Almost invariably, my friends, these pastorales end happily. We've listened to a pastorale. You didn't even realize it. As Vesta was from Latmos Hill descending, admittedly very limited in its scope, is a pastorale. We've got these sylvan deities, these nymphs, these shepherds, these goddesses, and so forth, all portrayed against this beautiful natural scene. Shakespeare's A Midsummer Night's Dream is a pastorale. And the first operas, based as they are on the legend of Orpheus and Eurydice, are also pastorales. Now, a momentary diversion, please. Take this stuff about pastorale and put it not in deep memory, but in middling memory, because I've got to introduce another chunk of information, and then we'll get back to these pastorales. We've got to talk about the so-called Florentine camerata. A camerata was a club or a coterie. We must talk about the redato, because actually what the Florentine camerata was a redato, R-I-D-O-T-T-O. That means a private academy or intellectual club. Many such were established in Italy during the Renaissance. Now, it would be a mistake to think of a redato as merely a boys' club, you know, a poker night, a bowling team. It was much more than that. But they weren't quite what we would think of today as think tanks. What they were groups of professionals, or intellects, or self-styled intellects, who were fascinated by a certain topic, and they would band together with others who were fascinated with like topics, and discuss and write tracts, and carry on into the night about their favorite topics. Kind of like a faculty meeting, frankly. I would compare these redatti to faculty meetings and groupings of well-educated but often hostile or at least self-interested people arguing the merits of their point of view of their favorite discipline. Now, the so-called Florentine camerata was a redatto, and they met in the home of a rich Florentine patron named Giovanni Bardi di Vernio. And Bardi lived from 1534 to 1612. And the camerata met in his house, and if you go to Florence, there's a plaque on the palace, it's still there, that says this is where met the Florentine camerata from 1573 to 1592. He hosted them for 19 years. Now, what did the camerata in Florence talk about? They talked about literature and science and art, indeed. But especially they talked about music and drama. These were the topics that most fascinated the members of this group, the nature and power of musical and dramatic expression. Now, among the members of the Florentine camerata that met at Bardi's house was Vincenzo Galilei. Vincenzo Galilei was born in 1533 and died in 1591, so he was an exact contemporary of the host of Bardi. And by the way, he was also the father of the astronomer Galileo Galilei. Vincenzo Galilei was a student of ancient Greek music and theater, or so he fancied himself, given as much as was known about ancient Greek music at this time. Galilei's ideas regarding ancient Greek music and theater were powerfully influenced by the work of a Florentine scholar named Girolamo Mei, M-E-I. Now, stay with me. I'm giving you a lot of names, but I'll tie them together in a second. May was older than all of these people. He was born in 1519, and he died in 1594. May's research, incidentally, inspired and titillated the entire Florentine Camerata, not just Galilei, but we'll find out why Galilei is the most important of the group in a moment. But back to May. May had come to the conclusion, through his research, mostly conducted in Rome, that the Greeks were able to obtain powerful effects with their music because it consisted of a single melody, whether sung solo, accompanied, or sung by a chorus. This single melody could affect the listener's feelings, since it would exploit the natural expressiveness, the rise and falls, and the register of the single human voice. In 1581, Vincenzo Galilei wrote a tract, a treatise, entitled Dialogue Concerning Ancient and Modern Music, where he, and by extension, the entire Florentine Camerata, declared open hunting season on the Italian madrigal as they knew it. And, of course, this tract was based on the writings and works of Girolamo May. Claude Palisca tells us what Galileo wrote all about. Following the doctrines of May, Galilei attacked the theory and practice of vocal counterpoint, as exemplified by the Italian madrigal. His argument was, in brief, that only a single line of melody with appropriate pitches and rhythms could express a given line of poetry. Therefore, when several voices simultaneously sang different melodies and words, music could never deliver the emotional message of the text. The emotional message of the text, my friends, not the meaning of the words, the emotions beneath the words. Palisca continues, when some voices were low and others high, some rising and others descending, some moving in slow notes and others in fast, the resulting chaos of contradictory impressions served only to show off the cleverness of the composer and the ability of the singers. Word painting, imitations of sighing, and the like, Galilei dismissed as childish. The correct way to set words, Galilei said, was to use a solo melody which would follow the natural speech inflections of a great orator or actor. So the Camerata develops a theory of new music, what they called the three corollaries, based on the Greek ideal of expressivity as enumerated by Girolamo May. And these are the three corollaries. Number one, the text must always be clearly understood. Now, please, this goes far beyond the ideas of articulation we've talked about in previous lectures, because what the Camerata is saying is that the only way for the text to be understood is for it to be sung by one singer, one at a time, period, accompanied as simply as possible with no vocal polyphony. Corollary number two, the words must be sung with correct and natural declamation. That means they should be sung the way they would be spoken, with the same accents, the same pacing, the same rise and fall. There should be no dance rhythms asserted upon these words, and we should avoid textual repetitions except for rhetorical reinforcement. Rhetorical. And thirdly, the melody must not depict mere graphic details, as we would in word or tone painting, but rather must interpret the feelings and emotions of the character singing them. Now, do we see the huge difference with this theory? The Camerata is positing that we must seek the emotions beneath the words rather than illustrate simply the literal meaning of the words. Very influential tract, and it gets a lot of folks, especially in Florence, to thinking about what kind of music would result if we did all of these things. All right, let's continue to trace the history of the Camerata a little further. Starting around 1592, the Camerata was sponsored and hosted by a new patron, this one named Jacopo Corsi. By now, the Camerata includes among its members some very important artists. And they're all artists of the next generation. I'll give you their birth dates, and we'll hear they're all born 25 or 30 years after the earlier Camerata members were. But these are very important artists. Camerata members now include Giulio Caccini, who is a well-known composer and a singer. He was born in 1546 and died in 1618. Jacopo Peri, composer, singer, organist, director of the ducal court, that is the music in the court of de' Medici. He was born in 1561, died in 1633. And Ottavio Rinuccini, a poet born in 1562 and died in 1621. My friends, with talent like this hanging out together, we now have a think tank. We now have the equivalent of a very high-level college faculty research facility trading important ideas about art and the nature of expression. These three gentlemen, Caccini, Peri, and Rinuccini, invent opera in the last years of the 16th century. By the way, before I go on and talk about the invention of opera, I just have to mention one last thing. Today, when we get together and we chat in think tanks and research groups, we chat about economics, we chat about the globalization of our world, we chat about technology, we chat about these essential issues which seem to affect our world. In 1595, they chatted about art and communication and about expression, because these were as intrinsic and singular to their culture as economics, globalization, politics, and technology are to our culture. Frankly, they had it better off. I would think it would be most marvelous if we had whole research groups dedicated to the nature of human expression and communication through the arts. I would like to be party to that one. So please, let's take this very seriously, and let's understand that these people lie at the philosophical and intellectual cutting edge of their culture, and that opera also lies at the philosophical and cutting edge of its culture. It's not merely an entertainment, at least not yet. The first operas, please. The first opera was a piece called Daphne. Ottavio Rinuccini wrote the libretto, and Jacopo Peri wrote the music. They teamed up in 1598 to create this piece, but sadly, the music has been lost. So we don't know what Daphne sounded like. Then Rinuccini wrote a libretto about the Orpheus and Eurydice story, and it was set two times in the same year. Twice in the year 1600, with a few changes here and there, Rinuccini's Eurydice was set. It was set by Giulio Caccini in 1600 and produced in 1602. And Rinuccini's Eurydice was also set by Jacopo Peri, also in 1600. But Peri's version of this story was first performed also in 1600 and then was published immediately in 1601, February of 1601. So, for our purposes, and rightly, the first opera, or the oldest surviving opera, must be Jacopo Peri's Eurydice, libretto by Ottavio Rinuccini. All right, let's jump in. Peri's Eurydice was first performed on October 6th of 1600 at the Pitti Palace in Florence as part of the wedding festivities of Henry V of France and Marie de Medici. It is a fully sung theatrical work alternating three elements, two old and one very new. All right, the old elements first. We hear choruses. Indeed, the chorus is used in the Greek way to comment on the action and to narrate what's going on. And we also hear rhymed, that is, pop-style songs, used as interludes to the action at scene ends and at scene beginnings. Now, this should sound to all of you just like an intermezzo, because this is what happens in an intermezzo. We hear songs and choruses at the beginnings and ends of scenes as commentaries. Those are the two old elements. But now the new element, element three. The body of the text of the play was also sung in what was called the stile rappresentativo, the representative style. This is early recitative, early recitation, and it lies at the heart and soul of this new Florentine music. Peri wrote about this stile rappresentativo. I quote Peri. I believed that the ancient Greeks and Romans, who, according to the opinion of many, sang their tragedies throughout, used a kind of music more advanced than ordinary speech, but less than the melody of singing, thus taking a middle position between the two. Peri's stile rappresentativo is not quite song, And it's not recitative in the later sense, as we will hear in Mozart, for example. Its basis is on an absolutely faithful adherence to the natural rhythms, inflections, and accents of spoken word, of the text. So it's going to sound kind of chant-like, with a rise and fall of pitch, but the rhythms are absolutely the rhythms of spoken language. All right, quickly, the story of Orpheus and Eurydice, and then we'll move on and sample a bit of the Peri. Please remember, Orpheus is a demigod. That is, he's the son of Apollo, a god, but of a mortal woman. Why we don't call him a semigod, I don't know. Maybe we should. Anyway, Orpheus is half and half. He's also a cocky, golden-tongued singer and lyre player whose songs can change the face of nature and even change the hearts of the gods. My friends, the significance of Orpheus then in the history of opera is clear. Orpheus is the personification of the Greek view of music, and therefore he becomes the personification of the power of opera, the power of words and music. And the Orpheus legend has been set to music more than any other single story in the history of opera. We have Peri's Orpheus, we have Caccini's, we have Monteverdi's, we have Gluck's, we have Stravinsky's, we have others I haven't mentioned. We even have a bossa nova samba Orpheus. Go out and rent the movie Black Orpheus. It's a wonderful version of the story that takes place in Rio during Carnival, and the music, most of which is by Antonio Carlos Jobim, combines both Brazilian samba and bossa nova. Anyway, back to our story. Eurydice is the beautiful but haughty nymph that Orpheus is in love with, and he finally, through constant singing and cajoling, convinces her to marry him. During the preparation for the wedding, Eurydice is out plucking flowers for a garland for her hair when, of course, Murphy's Law being what it is, she puts her foot down right next to a venomous snake who bites her, and of course, pow, she drops dead. But just before she dies, what does she say? She calls for Orpheus. There's a very famous scene in almost every Orpheus story where the messenger, some young nymph, has to come and tell Orpheus what's happened. And it's a moment of signal drama when the whole world changes, when our golden-tongued singer is struck dumb. And, of course, he's informed by the messenger, who's named Sylvia sometimes, Daphne sometimes, whatever. He's informed, and then he speaks the famous words, "I will go down to Hades, and with my lyre as my only weapon, I will bring her back to the sunshine of the overworld." Indeed, he charms his way into the court of Pluto, convinces Pluto that he should bring his woman back to the top, but Pluto lays down the famous condition. "You may bring her back to the overworld. We will set this precedent just for you, providing you don't turn around to see if she's really behind you." And Orpheus cannot control himself. He does turn around. She was there. She falls back forever into Hades. Disconsolate, Orpheus comes to the upper world. He forswears women forever, which, of course, incenses a mob of furies who then proceed to tear him apart, throwing his head into a river which floats downstream. Those darn furies, we met them in a previous lecture, didn't we? They hounded Orestes into madness. My friends, safety hint, don't mess with the furies. All right, back to Peri's Eurydice. Let's listen to the messenger song and Orfeo's, that's the Italian for Orpheus, Orfeo's response, because we want to hear what this new stile rappresentativo, this early recitative, sounds like. The messenger's name in this version is Daphne. Please, I would read. "In the beautiful thicket," oh, she's telling the story to Orpheus and the shepherds. "In the beautiful thicket where watering the flowers slowly courses the spring of the laurel, she took sweet delight with her companions, the beautiful bride. As some picked violets, others roses, to make garlands for their hair in the meadow or among the thorns. Another, lying on her side on the flowered bank, sang sweetly to the murmur of the waves." So it's a very idyllic sylvan scene. "But the lovely Eurydice dancingly moved her feet on the green grass when, oh, angry, bitter fate, a snake cruel and merciless that lay hidden among flowers and grass bit her foot with such an evil tooth that she suddenly became pale, and like a ray of sunshine that a cloud darkens. And from the depths of her heart, a mortal sigh, so frightful, alas, I may, flew forth almost as if it had wings. Every nymph rushed to the painful sound, and she, fainting, let herself fall into another's arms. Then spread over her beautiful face and her golden tresses a sweat, colder by far than ice. And then was heard your name sounding between her lips, cold and trembling, and her eyes turned to heaven, her beautiful face and mien discolored. This great beauty was transformed to motionless ice. Orpheus cannot speak. He's struck dumb, so one of the shepherds speaks for him. What do you relate? Oime, what do I hear? Wretched nymph and most unhappy lover, spectacle of sorrow and of torment. And finally Orpheus finds his voice, slowly at first. I do not weep, nor do I sigh. Oh, my dear Eurydice, for I am unable to sigh, to weep. Unhappy corpse, oh, my heart, oh, my hope, oh, peace, oh, life. Oime, who has taken you from me? Who has taken you away? Oime, where have you gone? Soon, soon you will see that not in vain did you, dying, call your spouse. I am not far away. I come, oh, dear life, oh, dear death. All right, 3 points before we listen to this section of music. First, if you can hear it, I want you to notice that there's a natural progression to Daphne's speech. At first, it's emotionally neutral as she sets the scene. But as she tells the story of the snake bite, more and more harmonies come, more and more dissonance is heard to correspond with her feelings and the story. Second point, I want you to note the growing sense of conviction we hear in Orpheus's voice as he communicates his intent to go and get his Eurydice. And thirdly, I want you to note the declamation. Clear, oratorical declamation lies at the heart of this stile representativo. The words are crystal clear. Let us listen. Perry's Eurydice of 1600.
Oh! mari, oime, che sento misera ninfa e più misero amante. Spettacol di miseria e di tormento. Non pianto e non sospiro, o mia cara Euridice, che sospirar e lacrimar non posso, davvero infelice. Mio cuore, mia speme, pace, vita, vedrai che in vano non chiamasti morendo il tuo consorte. Non so lontano io vengo, cara vita, cara morte.
Now I know what some of you are thinking right now. You're thinking, that's it? Because it sounds a little flat to our ears. We're used to histrionics, we're used to singing, we're used to up and down. Yes, that's it. That's the first experiment with this new stile rappresentativo, the new recitative. But it's a fabulous and important beginning for reasons I'll mention in just a moment. One last note about Eurydice before we move on. Perry's orchestra, if we can call it that for Eurydice, employed but four instruments, hidden behind the screen so that they wouldn't distract the audience. This ensemble of four instruments consists of a harpsichord, two large lutes, and a lira grande, a big early bowed stringed instrument. Now look, the smallness of this ensemble tells us something that we already suspect. Eurydice was, a drama with music, not a musical drama. It's very important we make that distinction. It's a play set to music rather than a play conceived musically. But minimal though the music may have been, Perry's Eurydice was and is an epical and important work. There can be no doubt that these first composers of dramatic recitative at Florence towards the end of the 16th century believed that they were renewing a musical practice of the ancient Greeks, and that in doing so, they were accomplishing something of revolutionary importance. Indeed, they were. Which brings us to Claudio Monteverdi, 1567 to 1643. Now, my friends, opera was invented by original and talented men, people like Rinuccini and Caccini and Peri. They were intent on recreating the ancient Greek expressive ideal. The continuation of opera, however, the flowering of opera, came at the hands of a great genius, and that was Claudio Monteverdi. When we return for lecture six, we will talk about Monteverdi and this signal and most important early opera, Orfeo of 1607. Thank you. Welcome back to How to Listen to and Understand Opera. This is Lecture 6, the second of a four-lecture set entitled The Invention of Opera and Monteverdi's Orfeo. And we have been brought to the edge, my friends. We have witnessed the invention of opera. Right now, it's still basically a dramatic production with the addition of music, but now opera transcends its early beginnings very quickly. I mean, it takes just 7 years from the time of the first opera to the time of the first operatic masterwork, and that's what Monteverdi's Orfeo is, the first operatic masterwork created by the first great genius writing in the operatic medium. I would take this moment to introduce one of the many gratuitous statements I make during this course, and this is something I've said before and will undoubtedly say again. I've got a special soft spot in my heart for Monteverdi, aside from the fact that he's a brilliant composer who can write in any style, and we'll talk about that in a moment. But especially, it's his name, Monteverdi, Mountain Green. It's Greenberg in Italian. And that's why it's important when people spell my name that they spell the end, B-E-R-G, which means mountain, as opposed to B-U-R-G, which means town. Exactly. I'm Green Mountain, and Monteverdi is Mountain Green. Darn it. At some spiritual level, we've got to be paisan. We've got to be perhaps even cugini, cousins. I would love to think so. Anyway, onward, please. Monteverdi was born in Cremona, that marvelous northern Italian city of madrigals and violins. He's trained by Marc Antonio Ingegneri, the head of music at the Cremona Cathedral. In 1590, Monteverdi enters the service of Vincenzo Gonzaga, the Duke of Mantua, and 12 years later, in 1602, he becomes master of the ducal chapel. In 1613, and indeed until the time of his death 30 years later, in 1643, Monteverdi becomes choir master at St. Mark's Cathedral in Venice. This is as good a gig as exists in Italy, and Italy is as good a place to live as exists in the 17th century. The only other job of such equal status as choir master at St. Mark's would be the choir master at the Sistine Chapel in Rome, the private chapel, of course, of the Pope. Now, Monteverdi was equally adept at writing in any style. He produced books and books and books of Renaissance-style madrigals. He could write in the what we call the polychoral style of St. Mark's Cathedral. That is, St. Mark's has these huge choir lofts, and composers took to writing for multiple simultaneous choirs. And Monteverdi wrote brilliant pieces like his Vespers that employed this technique. And he was equally adept at the new operatic style, the new art. Monteverdi wrote 19 stage works, and only 6 of these stage works have survived intact. If anyone is listening and would love to make a life's contribution to the art and Western civilization, please find the other 13. I'd love to think that they were around somewhere, buried in a cistern in some place or another. I mean, here we have one of the great opera composers, and only 6 of his works have survived intact. Among the ones that have survived intact are his first opera, Orfeo, of 1607, and his last opera, The Coronation of Poppea, of 1642. Now, it is in Monteverdi's hands that opera passes out of the experimental stage. His operas become models for the next 4 generations of composers. Donald Grout tells us, "The music of Orfeo was greeted by contemporaries as another example of the Florentine style, and indeed the general plan of the opera, that is, it's a pastorale and it uses lots of recitative, would seem to justify this view. Nevertheless, the differences between Monteverdi and what came before him are fundamental. Monteverdi was a musician of genius, soundly trained in technique, concerned very much with musical and dramatic truth, and very little with antiquarian theories. He combined the madrigal style of the late 16th century with the orchestral and scenic apparatus of the old intermezzi and a new conception of the possibilities of recitative and solo singing. Orfeo represents the first attempt to apply the full resources of the art of music to opera, unhampered by any limitations. In the words of Robert Donington, we do not praise Monteverdi for originality, but for inspiration. And that's an important point, because as we talk about Orpheus, we will remind ourselves that what makes it so brilliant is that it synthesizes all that exists about Monteverdi into a single piece. Inspiration. He didn't invent opera, but he was inspired to create a new operatic ideal. All right. Orfeo, 1607, libretti, libretto by Alessandro Striggio. All right. We'll examine this opera from two different points of view. First, as a self-contained drama with music, simply as an opera. But as I just said, we will also examine it as an incredible synthesis of musical genres and compositional techniques. Indeed, a synthesis of genres and techniques that were extant and available in 1607. It is in many ways an early Gesamtkunstwerk, a term coined by Wagner many centuries later to mean the all-inclusive artwork. Well, Monteverdi's Orfeo is an all-inclusive artwork, inclusive of everything that was available to a composer in 1607. He combines, he synthesizes, first, this awesome, unique talent for dramatic recitative. Please, there's no such thing as an aria yet. We'll talk about that in later lectures. He combines with this amazing recitative a full range of instrumentation and instrumental writing techniques. He combines with that madrigal choruses, and he combines with that rhymed pop-style songs and dances. So let's begin at the beginning with what he calls the toccata, or what we would more modernly call the overture. That Orfeo was meant to be performed in a very large hall, as opposed to the small room the Peri would be performed in, becomes abundantly clear at the very first notes of this overture. Monteverdi's instrumental ensemble is, by the standards of his time, gargantuan. We hear 40 or more players employing a dazzling variety of different instruments. I would list them for you now. And I say 40 or more because this ensemble can be and has been augmented to be even larger. We have a score that calls for two harpsichords, two double bass viols, which means big basses, 10 viole da braccio. These would be arm-rested viols. They are the ancestors of the modern violin. One double harp, two violini piccoli alla francese. These are these pint-sized French dance fiddles that he asks for. Two large lutes, which are called chitarroni. Remember that, because I'm going to invoke the chitarroni. The chitarroni, when they're plucked, sounds for Monteverdi like the lutes of, excuse me, like the lyres of the ancient world. So when Orfeo is singing and playing his lyre, we will be hearing one or both of the chitarroni. Two organs with wooden pipes, three bass viols, the equivalent of a modern cello, four trombones, a portable organ, two cornets, a medium alto recorder, one high trumpet, three muted trumpets, a harp, a guitar, three soprano recorders, and optional percussion. And there are those extra instruments that could be added. Oh, my goodness, where are they going to put all these people? Well, that's the problem of the stage director. Monteverdi calls for a band of huge size. The toccata is a brilliant and expanded version of the sort of fanfare which customarily began theatrical entertainments. It's scored for full orchestra in three parts. In part one, we hear the fanfare and everyone plays it. Part two repeats the fanfare, but now played a little more quietly by just strings and winds. And then part three, everyone comes back and plays the whole fanfare again. Let's listen to the toccata and let's ask ourselves what sort of production this music will be preparing us for. Monteverdi, Orfeo, toccata.